of the all the commandments in the Torah? Okay, that's the question. Okay? Maimonides says there are two reasons. He says one is because of our social fabric, to put the to make sure that people work together as a unit. And two is to train the mind. There is no better book than the Talmud for training the mind. And therefore, since the train you to search for God and to even relate to God through the mitzvahs, you need a trained mind. There has to be a book that trains you. And therefore, the best book that you could find is the system of Talmud and Halacha, which is the same subject, different aspects of the same subject. There is no better system for the training of the mind. And the question is, I seem to have said the same thing about Proverbs. What I said about Proverbs is that Proverbs does train the mind in a different area, but however, it is not as abstract as Talmud. Okay? Then there are different commentaries that show how the different commandments, how they benefit in particular the different areas. Avram ben Arambam, Avram the son of the Maimonides, wrote a book on how the different commandments benefit the person, and that book has been translated into English. So there he talks about the different areas of perfection and which mitzvahs help you. He defines what the perfection is, and he clarifies which commandments help you with the various areas of perfection. Even though there are other commentaries that approach it differently and have different interpretations of what the benefits are. The question is that the Noahide, wherein lies perfection of the Noahide laws? If you notice, all the Noahide laws are negative, except one that you have to have a court to make sure that the six others are maintained, and they're all what you're not permitted to do. So it prevents you from going totally wild in your personal life, to be totally, without any control. So therefore, it prevents you from losing total control as a society. But however, insofar as benefiting the person, that the Noahides do not have any commandments for the positive. Now the question is, let's take Shabbos, for instance. A Noahide is not permitted to keep Shabbos, and that would help him be perfected. Okay? The answer is that he can't keep the laws of Shabbos, but he can keep the philosophy behind Shabbos. In other words, let's say, for instance, Shabbos, according to one interpretation, is a day that you should spend in learning. It represents the idea that you should spend in learning. So you could do that on Shabbos. You could take more time to learn on Shabbos. But you can't keep the Shabbos, but you can keep the philosophy of that perfection, and in that way you can perfect yourself. So therefore, if you get the philosophy behind the commandments, then you'll be able to live according to those ideas. Even though a Noahide is not permitted to keep the laws themselves, but they could live the philosophy of the laws. In Pirkei Avos, that's Ethics of the Fathers, Chapter 3, Mishnah, in one book it's 9, in one book it's 11. It says, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa Omer, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa says, he says, all whose fear of sin takes priority over his wisdom will endure. But anyone whose wisdom takes priority over his fear of sin, his wisdom will not endure. The first thing that we have to do is the question, what is fear of sin? What does he mean by fear of sin? Now, the first thing is that before we do that, Rashi on this Mishnah quotes a verse, and he says, just 1 second. Oh, he quotes a pasuk, a verse that says, if there is no fear of God, there is no wisdom. So fear of sin and fear of God, he's equating as being the same thing. So the question is, what is the fear of God and what is the fear of sin? And now in Mishlei, Proverbs, verse 7, it says, the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge, and wisdom and musa means training, right? Training in everyday life. Fools, they disgrace, they make fun of, they put down. Okay? The word musa could be the training of the personality. Okay? We'll define it a little better later. And fools disgrace, put down, and they will make fun of. Okay? Now since the Mishlei Proverbs is always written in opposites, so since the first half is the fear of God, the opposite would be non-fear of God, and that is, and he says that they despise Musar. They despise guidance. Okay? So you see that God, what he calls Musar, or guidance, and the beginning of knowledge, you see that and the fear of the Lord are the same thing. In other words, his book is written to train you in the fear of God. Now again, back to Proverbs, Rashi also says, what does it mean it will not last? That if you do not have the fear of sin, it will not last. So he says that what it means is, he says, if he doesn't have the fear of God, so then his wisdom will not last. It means ein bo mamish. Mamish means like substance. It's not. It is no real substance, ubatla, and it's null and void. Okay, all his knowledge is null and void. Question is, what does null and void mean? Null and void means, let's say, for instance, you have a contract, and you make the contract null and void. So then, what's written in it has no is nothing. It's just a piece of paper. Before it was a contract that represents a legal transaction or legal obligations. When it's null and void, that thing only represents a piece of paper. The same thing that if it's has substance to it and there's something to it, so then there's a benefit. Then you fear the God. But if you study all this knowledge that he studies, math, science, physics, whatever he studies, will be equal to nothing. Okay? Will not have any substance, and it will be null and void. There's nothing to it. The question is, what does Rashi mean by this idea? And I'd like to give an example from Proverbs. It's chapter 29, verse 1. It says, a man that needs guidance, but he hardens his neck, in other words, he's stubborn, suddenly he will be broken and he will not be healed. Okay? Question is, what is the verse talking about? And why sudden? I mean, why? I understand if he said that he'll break, he'll be destroyed. But why sudden? Okay? Alright. A big problem in medicine is that people, in other words, you could be sick and you don't realize it. And therefore, the disease is getting worse, and then suddenly you're going to die. You understand? Suddenly it's a catastrophe. But the truth is it's not sudden. The truth is you just were unaware of the thing happening. That's why today they always say to try to find out as much as possible and take tests beforehand so you should know what's happening so you can catch it beforehand. Same thing with a person that doesn't study the consequences of his actions. With his mind, he didn't train himself to see the future based on knowledge, not prophecy, to see the future based on knowledge and ideas, what the consequences and what the results will be. So therefore, the person that doesn't, so therefore his mind is totally closed to what's going to happen. So since it's totally closed to what's going to happen, so therefore suddenly the catastrophe comes, and he says, oh boy, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't, you know, he's suddenly there. And he doesn't understand why it happens. And he can't heal himself because he doesn't have the knowledge, and now it's too late. The throes of the consequence, it's very hard to deal with the problem, especially if you weren't trained to deal with these type of problems. The opposite would be a person that has the fear of God, namely, that he sees the consequences of his actions, and he realizes that it could bring about, that what he's going to do now could bring about consequences, and the same thing is in his relationship to God. He's going to relate to God in an incorrect way. There will be consequences. So the thing is, and so therefore, he knows the he recognizes what's going to happen, and therefore, he will see the consequences and protect himself against it. And now the question is, what is the difference between the person that cannot accept training and the person that can? What is the difference in the training itself? What happens when you train yourself? What happens from before you were trained till after you were trained? What is the change in the person that occurs? What happens is that everybody has a certain sense of reality. But their sense of reality is dependent on only the five senses. The sense of reality only attaches to the five senses. Everything else that he does is based on his society. We happen to live in a very practical society, and so people do things, it seems like they're intelligent, but they're only a result of their society. While there is a, if you were raised in Haiti, 50 or 100 years ago, then you would be sticking pins in dolls. You understand? Because you were raised in that society. You see? So the thing is that, so all the other actions, even though like in the United States, it seems like people are doing the practical thing, the reason why they're doing it is only because they were raised that way, their society does it. But insofar as their sense of reality, to most people, the sense of reality only attaches to the five senses. Okay? What we're saying, you have to extend your sense of reality to the world of ideas. To the world of ideas. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, I desire to do something stupid. Now, that desire right now is an experience. I'm experiencing that desire. But my mind tells me that I will have the consequences, but I'm not experiencing those consequences. Yet, right. But right now, I'm not experiencing it. So my mind has to decide to go against the experience that I'm having now. That is why you need the sense of reality to attach to the world of ideas. Because when it attaches to the world of ideas, it becomes strong enough to overcome the experience that you're having right now, so that you can act based on your mind and not based on what you're experiencing now. That is the purpose of the training of the book of Proverbs. Okay? Now, insofar as our statement in the Ethics of the Fathers that says that if you do not have the fear of the Lord, your wisdom will not endure, in other words, science, math, what he means is the reason why it's void and null and it has no substance, the reason for this is that it's, if you have not been trained, if, in other words, if your sense of reality doesn't extend to the world of ideas, so that which you are studying is not real. So the only reason why you're studying it is either because of some ego or competition, or because it's like a game to you, like a puzzle. That isn't your reality. A game or a puzzle isn't a reality, you see. Definitely the other emotions are not a reality. So therefore, it's not real in the sense that it has much value. Insofar as your personal life is concerned, your life is making a living, you know, working out, dealing with your family, you know, your practical everyday life. But his, for instance, some people are scientists, it's just a job. They have a job. It's their job, but it's not, it's only insofar as their job, but the ideas have no reality, you see? So therefore, if you study the world of Mishlei, and that study will help to extend the sense of reality to the world of ideas, and then you study the sciences, and you see the sciences, the reality of the science, then you are drawn to the Creator, who's the source of all that reality, you see, because you are drawn to reality. But if you do not have a, but if the sense of reality doesn't extend to the world of ideas, then all your learning has no value. You can't, there's no practicality in your life. It has really no value to you. It's like a piece of paper that has, it's like a legal piece of paper that was null and void. It's only worth the piece of paper. That's all it is. That is what I think is the idea in the Ethics of the Fathers. In other words, the last clause of that statement in Ethics of the Fathers means that he has knowledge without fear of God. In other words, the sense of reality does not extend to the world of ideas. He doesn't have the world of consequences, and therefore, because he doesn't have that, so he doesn't have the sciences either. Sciences have no real reality to them. The question is in Proverbs it uses stubborn, stiff-necked or stubborn. Stiff-necked or stubborn in Torah always means that he does not recognize the truth or reality, and he sticks by his feelings that he has now, these experiences, these feelings that he has now, whatever it is, he lives by those right now. But world of ideas, he will not accept that because he's afraid. I mean, one possibility, it could be many possibilities, but he's afraid that, you know, it will change his life. A lot of people, you know, they just want to enjoy their life, and this will cause terrible complications in their life, so they prefer not having it. I mean, there's just only one cause. There could be many others. Now, we would like to discuss the difference between the Chacham, the Tzaddik, and the Chassid. Okay? So one thing, we want to know the difference, and two, in Mishlei, in Proverbs, he talks about the Chacham and the Tzaddik, and in Tehillim he talks a lot about the Chassid. He also mentions the Tzaddik, but he talks mostly about the Chassid, so we want to know why these two books are divided in these two ways. Okay, these are what we'd like to deal with.
Okay.
We did this on another tape, but however, we're going to go over it with a certain clarification and extension, and especially about the Tzaddik. Okay, we didn't clarify the Tzaddik that time, so we'll clarify it now. Right. Again, the Chacham is a person that he extends his sense of reality from from the five senses to the world of ideas. And we said what that means is that he experiences now a certain desire, but his mind tells him that that will bring harm in the future, so he evaluates the harm versus the pleasure that he'll get now, or if he avoids pain, the avoidance of pain now and what he will get in the future. So the thing is that he's able, the mind is able to deal, able to overcome the desire. Now, you also have to be very careful. I'm not talking about sometimes a person has a conscience, and the conscience overcomes desire. You see, I'm not talking about where the conscience overcomes desire, especially in the United States where there's certain practical things, like people go to college, you have to make a living, and things like that. So people think they're rational, but really what they're doing is only, it's only they're following the society. And it's not the mind dictating. Like certain people don't eat certain foods. I mean, it's because they were raised that way. They have a certain society. They caught up with certain fears. But it's not the mind evaluating. Mind evaluating means you're a different type of person. And it's the mind itself that's able to overcome the experience, that pleasure that you have now, that desire that you have now. It's able to, the mind is able to see the harm and consequence and able to stop you immediately. The question is, what motivates the Chacham? So he said what motivates the Chacham is is he sees that he could prevent a tremendous amount of pain and consequences in the future, and he sees that life as better than the life where he gives in to his emotions immediately. Whatever he desires, he gives into. He sees that he gives into it immediately. So he sees that's not a good life. So practically, he sees that this is the better life. And so therefore, he rather live this life. So it's because he sees the benefit of this life. Insofar as the tzaddik is concerned, I'd like to read to you a portion of the Talmud. It's in the Brachos, Tractate Brachos, and it is Nunches Amid Aleph, or 58a, okay, in Brachos. And I will read from the translation, so it'll be easy for everybody to understand. He used to say, he is Ben Zoma. He said something before, and now they're continuing about things that he said. So he says, he used to say, how many exertions did Adam, the first man, make until he found bread to eat? He plowed, he sowed, he reaped. He gathered the stalks together, he threshed the stalks, he winnowed the chaff from the grain, he selected the other waste from the grain, he ground the grain into flour, he sifted the flour, he kneaded the flour into dough, he baked the dough, and afterwards he ate the bread. But I, Ben Zoma says, but I rise early in the morning and find all these labors already prepared for me. He continues, how many exertions did Adam the first man make until he found a garment to wear? He shared the wool, he cleaned it, he disentangled it, he spun it into threads, he wove the threads, and afterwards he found a garment to wear. But I rise early in the morning and find all these labors already prepared before me. What he's saying is when you work within a society and civilization, so when everybody does their job, there is less work to do than when one person has to do every single piece of job, every single step of every job. You see, you never get done. But over here in civilization, he's saying the benefit of a civilization. But he says, but the question is, why doesn't he say, and I rise early in the morning and I find all these things prepared before me. Now, why doesn't he say everybody finds it? Why does he say I? Yeah. He makes it I as if it's special for him. Yeah. Okay? Okay, so the question is, why does he say I? Okay? The answer is like this. Most people cannot enjoy the product of civilization. The reason why they can't is, let's take competition. So I have to work very hard for competition, like the people that ran Enron. They worked day and night. They made millions. They're very wealthy. But the thing is they did not have the pleasures and the benefits of civilization. They worked as hard as Adam worked. No different than Adam. Except they were working for greed. Adam was working for practicality. But there's no difference. Who enjoys civilization? A very practical person. Person that recognizes his needs, like food and clothing. He likes a nice house, comfortable house, you see. But his desires are not like a lot of people are trying to live on a higher level, you know, to move up the ladder, you see. He has no desire to move up the ladder. He just has a desire for his needs and even some emotional needs to take care of. But it's not extreme, you understand? So therefore, he can truly enjoy a civilization, okay? And he recognizes the benefit of a civilization, but most people cannot enjoy the civilization. Why? Because they're caught up with greed, competition, jealousy, vengeance, all these emotions, ego, all these emotions that drive the person for these successes that have, and excesses that have no real value in your life, so they're constantly driven for all these things, you see? So they don't really appreciate society. They're very good to build society. But the one that really appreciates society is the person that lives a very practical life, you see? Okay? Now, that person could really enjoy, do the things that he really enjoys, okay? So therefore, he recognizes the value of the system more than anybody else. Everybody else only looks for their own personal satisfaction. So they take away from the society, like the people of Enron. Their greed made them take away from society, you see, and destroy large parts of society, the economy. It affected in a large part the economy, you see. So therefore they're only interested in themselves. But the tzaddik, who recognizes the value of the society, he wants to benefit the society. He wants to make sure he keeps the system and maintains the system, and will even try to educate others to keep the system, so that, because if the system works, then he can have his good life, you see? So therefore, like James says, if it crashes, the civilization crashes, then he's back to Adam. Okay. But the thing is that that is the tzaddik, you see? So the tzaddik, again, is motivated by a practicality that he sees that the better life is if civilization works correctly. And therefore, he's into justice to make sure that civilization works correctly. Now the question is, what's the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik? The difference is the Chacham only sees the particulars. When he's in competition with others, he can't see the universal system, because he still has these conflicts. You see what I mean? He sees the benefit of living the life of the wisdom and preparing himself for consequences, but insofar as society, his emotions don't allow him to see the benefit of society. You see why? Because the thing is that it's conflicts with other people, his jealousies, his competition, his greed, or whatever emotion is driving him, doesn't allow him to see the benefit of society. So therefore, the development is he lowers his competitive type of emotions, these negative type of emotions that don't let him really enjoy the produce and products of society, because he's involved in the battle among people, so he can't see the benefit of society. So he could be a chacham, but he can't be a tzaddik. But as the chacham develops, so he removes these negative, he sees the harm of these negative emotions in his everyday life. You see that he sees. He sees that, you see that throughout Mishlei, the chacham sees in his everyday life, he sees that these emotions are not good for him. So therefore, as he lowers these emotions, either removes them or lowers them, or his mind shows him the, even if he has them, but is able to overcome it with his mind, then he's able to recognize the benefit of society, and then he will become a tzaddik. That is the nature of the tzaddik and the motive of the tzaddik. Now, therefore, many people could have ideas. They could know these ideas, you see. The development is not in the ideas, but the study of the ideas is the development of your emotions and what motivates you. In other words, you could have these ideas, but if it doesn't change the way you feel about life, and it doesn't change that the mind affects your emotions, you see, then knowledge is of no value.
Now that's what I meant by how do you...
And the way to make the switch in the emotion is by constant review of, in every different angle, of these ideas of the consequences. That's why we have a book like Mishlei, okay, which goes over all these things, okay? Now, all these ideas. Now, the question is, why in Mishlei does it have the Chacham and the Tzaddik? Is because they both have the same motive. The motive is practicality.
Okay.
You see, the motive is practicality, and therefore he still thinks of himself and what is beneficial for me. So when he helps others, it's because he sees, when he's a righteous person, he sees the benefit to himself of being just, so therefore he's willing to work for the system of justice because he sees the benefit of that lifestyle. So therefore, both the Chacham and the Tzaddik are both practical people. Just two levels of the same motive, or the same personality. Now the Chassid, on the other hand, like we said also last time, is basically the Chassid is a person that studies God's Hashgacha, God's supervision, and how he works with us through the system of good and evil in the world, and also science. You see different sciences that he discusses it. And now when you see God's wisdom, how he relates to the world, so then there's a qualitative change in the person, and it draws him to relate to the God, the source of all his wisdom. You see? And then he wants to be in line with God's will. So then when he does justice, he does it because it's the will of God. So here's a qualitative change. It's not practical, but it's because he sees the truth and he sees that it's God's will, so he does it because of God's will. Okay? But the only thing is you have to understand, when you reach the level of a chassid, there are times in certain situations where a person must pull back to the earlier level. In other words, if there's a very powerful emotion that affects your there's a situation that affects your emotions in an adverse way, where the objectivity of just for God is not enough, so then he has to revert to the lower level where he does the right thing for practicality. Okay? I mean, a person has to realize that when he reaches the second, it's not all or nothing. You see, he sometimes reverts, sometimes certain situations, he'll have to revert to the first stage, the first motivation of practicality, and the practicality will stop him from doing the incorrect act. In other words, when you hit a very deep emotion, sometimes the philosophical, in other words, purely because of God, that in other words, you can't. So what could help overcome it is the practicality that you don't want to hurt yourself. That's a very strong and powerful idea. So then you turn to that. That helps you overcome it. Okay? And like we see by our forefathers, like by Moshe, by different, they made mistakes, one or two mistakes in their life. You see that sometimes there's a situation where even going back, they can't go back, where it overcomes them totally, and they fail. We don't have, like I said many times, we don't have saints, we have human beings, and that we do have emotions, and these emotions sometimes hit us. But they are in a different ballpark. When you reach these levels, you're in a different ballpark. It's not that the emotions are not there, but you're in a different ballpark. The difference between the chacham and the regular person, the regular person is totally guarded by his emotions. He has no thoughts. I mean, he's just guarded by his emotions. Whatever his emotions tell him, that's what he does. So sometimes his animalistic part of him overcomes him and he does something there. Sometimes his conscience overcomes him and he works by the conscience, which could be an extreme also. And so therefore he goes back and forth between these two areas. But however, a chacham, and beyond that, is he's guided by ideas, but the two types of ideas is either because it's beneficial or because I see God's wisdom and I want to be a part of God's will, so therefore I do it for the will of God. In other words, the animalistic part of you and the conscience are both part of the unconscious part of the human being, which we call the Yetzirah, the evil inclination.
The conscience is?
The conscience also, because the conscience...
People don't think of it that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I know. I know most people don't think of it that way. That's correct. But however, you see that the conscience is like, let's say, the Inquisition was based on not the pleasure, but it was based on, you know, their religion and their God and their guilt, and everybody had to be exactly like them. And see, the real pleasure person is Ahasuerus, where he had a party and he allowed everybody to drink what they want out of what type of cups they want. He's just into fun. Everybody should enjoy themselves. But formality, where everybody has to think exactly my way, you see, that's the conscience. You see? That's the conscience talking. It's not the world of ideas. You see? But it's an unconscious part of the human being. Right. So the thing is, what we're saying here is that the conscience is the ability to be trained to control the animalistic part, but it still uses emotions like shame, fear, and guilt. So therefore, that is what controls the emotions. Okay, and what you're going to be is dependent on what society you're in. You see, like if you were raised in Haiti 100 years ago. So your conscience, the way you're raised, is you would stick pins in dolls, you know what I mean, when you want to hurt somebody, you know what I mean? But today in our society, our conscience is to go to school. You see, it's more than what it just so happens at this point in America, the conscience is more in line with a certain amount of reality. But however, that reality gets out of hand because of greed and all the rest of the emotions, the quantity. That's why you need the mind to make sure that you get the exact quantity to measure how far you should go and not to make a mistake by the conscience or any of the emotions or the animalistic part of you. And once again, clarification. The chacham and the tzaddik is in one category, which is they live by the mind because of practical reasons. The chassid is a totally different person. He's guided, qualitatively different. He's guided because he sees the wisdom in the world, the God's wisdom. So he's drawn to God through God's wisdom, and then he wants to be a part of God's will. And it has nothing to do with his benefit, but he just wants to do that which is part of God's will. You see, and even though it might not be beneficial, it usually is beneficial, but what motivates him is not the beneficiality of the act, but the will of God. The question is the chassid just extending his horizons, his views, more than the tzaddik? The answer is yes. He's definitely extending his views beyond that. But that change in views makes a qualitative change in the person. The qualitative change is what motivates him. In the Chacham and the Tzaddik, what motivates them is the practicality of having the best life with the least amount of pain, you see? But what motivates the Chassid is that what motivates him is to be in line with God's will. But it start. But that change in his personality starts with his extension of his studies into science and God's supervision, namely Hashgacha Pratis. The question is, what should a person strive for? The answer is that a person should strive to be a Chacham. When he first starts out, he wants to have the good life. So that's a natural development. Now, if he develops and he has more abilities, naturally, through his development, he will naturally become a tzaddik. You see? That's through the study of Mishlei. Then, what he does is he opens his horizons by studying the sciences and by studying God's Hashgacha. Once he has the first two, then he studies that the sciences, in other words, and you see God's wisdom, so therefore it's a further development. Whether you have the ability to get there, each person is different, and a person can only move based on his abilities, and his, first of all, his mental abilities, and his emotional abilities, how much energy he could put into it. So where you're going to go is based on your abilities. And let me clarify that point. In other words, first of all, there's mental differences. According to Rabbeinu Yonah, that there's some people that can only be a Chacham. That's it. They don't have the mental ability to go further, to go into the system of justice. System of justice not only is an emotional thing, and it's not only recognizing and removing your emotions, but it's the study of law. If you want to be a just person, you're going to have to study halacha. You see what I mean? So the question is your mental ability, you see? Then studying the sciences, how deep you can go into the sciences. I mean, you have Einstein on one hand, you have people, you know, mediocre IQ, you know what I mean? So how far you can go, not everybody can go the same distance. So that's what I mean by mental ability. So also by emotional ability, some people have the ability to study 18 hours a day and it doesn't bother them, they could just keep going. Some people could barely have the emotional ability to study 2 hours a day. You understand? If you study 2 hours a day, then you're not going to get as far as the person that could study 18 hours a day. And you can't drive yourself beyond your ability. You have to know yourself. If you go too far of your ability, then you'll harm yourself that way. If you go too little, then you harm yourself the other way. So the thing is, that's why you must use your mind to know exactly who and what you are and how far you could go. There is a natural development without thought. In other words, there's an infant, you know, that's totally dependent on his parents. Then he starts walking, and so his world becomes a little bigger. And then soon he comes out, and he suddenly has friends, you know what I mean? So he becomes bigger. And then as he gets older, there's a certain development, and then he has responsibilities, things like that. There's a natural development. Okay, there are certain people that this development is stunted and they have problems. That's why we have a psychiatrist to help them out where the development was stunted. Okay, but however, this development is not in the hands of the human being. This happens to you. You don't realize things are happening. They just happen. You look back and you notice that things happen. Okay, so that's a different type of development. It is true, that is an important development, and it's important to know when raising a child how to make sure not to stunt that development and allow that development to happen naturally. You see what I mean? But however, the person must be active. This is all passive. This happens naturally without thought. But then there's the active part of him, where he develops his mind, and as a part of his mind, he develops his thoughts. You see what I mean? So there's two types of developments. You understand? There's one type of development that every human being goes through in a normal society, in an unnatural society, and of course, a lot of these things break down and they never complete the cycle. They don't, and that's why we have problems. But however, that is a passive type of thing. It happens. What we're talking about is a more active type of development, where you take charge through your studies, through your knowledge, through your understanding. You start making decisions in a totally different way than the rest of society, the way people naturally think, because it's all passive. They're passive to the society and to their surroundings and to the way they were raised. They're passive to all that, you see. While the thinker, on the other hand, is active in the sense that he makes a decision to study, and he makes a decision when he should counter that emotion the way he was raised, and when he could give in to it. He makes that decision, so that's a more active type of involvement in your development. That is the difference between those two types of developments. Okay. The question is what is the best opportune time to make the more active, you see, the introduce the child to the more active type of thinking, okay? The answer is that, first of all, the child deals in an unconscious way when they're first starting out, and there is very little practicality. You have to notice in the child a certain development in their practicality. And also, when you try to train the child, anything that you train the child should be trained based on practicality and then controls. I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, going into the street, okay? Now, the child should be taught, in other words, should be taught the harm of being killed. You know what I mean? Not killed, but the harm of a car hitting you, the harm that it could hurt you, okay? And to try to educate the child, not by just telling him, by physically, you know, showing him, let's say you hit him, tap him with the thing, show him that it could hurt. We don't want to go too far by showing him dead animals on the side of the road. We don't want to frighten the kid, but we want to show him that it could harm him, you see. Then you must have consequences from the parent if it's not enough. But you should first try practicality without punishment, you see. Now, of course, if the kid is not going to listen, it doesn't help, and his kid's life is in danger, then, of course, then you're going to have to get involved and actually discipline the child. You understand? Whatever you want from the child, you must be able to see in your mind that it's practical, and to be able to explain it to him practically, and then discipline should follow based on the practicality. You should know there is a consequence for his actions. I can't put an exact date when the opportune time is, but I would say about 3 years old, you know what I mean? You could start with the practicality. Maybe if the kid's developed a little earlier, a little later, you know what I mean? You have to know your child where he can understand it. You understand there's certain things that he can't understand, like, for instance, like James gave the example, if there's a sand where people are working, he might not be able to understand that he could be hurt by this big machinery, and it's not in his realm of experience to be able to see that it could harm him. So then you might just have to control him. You understand? Where it's out of his realm of understanding. But that you have to see in your own child when it's the realm of understanding, that you have to make a decision when it's in the realm of understanding and when it is not. Okay. The discussion that we're doing, it says in the Gemara, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, says both are the words of the living God. Situation where two rabbis are arguing, both have different arguments, and they say when they both have different arguments, still in all, both are the words of the living God. Now the question is, how could God say two opposites? You understand? That's an impossibility. So the question is, how could you say that God said both? To clarify the question, in other words, if God gave a system It must be the best system, the best way to live. Since it's the best way to live, so only one of them is the best way to live. The other must be either incorrect or less of the best. It's not the best. So therefore, only one should be right. How can we say both are the words of the living God? The question is there a difference if when the Sanhedrin was in existence or not? The answer is no, because when the Sanhedrin was in existence, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, would have the two possibilities, and we would vote on it. And the vote would be how we act, but we don't know which one God said on Mount Sinai. In other words, God could have said the opposite on Mount Sinai. In other words, let's say whether a watch is wearing or carrying. Let's say God said it's carrying, and we made a decision that it's wearing, right? Then there's two logical possibilities. You see, we have two logical possibilities. The truth is we don't know which one God said, but we act according to the vote. You see, we're obligated to act according to the vote, and it's very possible that the vote went differently than what God said on Mount Sinai. You see, which is also a question, that we're not living the original system. How is that possible? You see? And today, definitely, where we don't have the Sanhedrin, there's a difference of opinion. So again, we have to act according to one or another. We have different methods of making a decision how to live, which way to live. But however, the thing is that there is no end. We didn't remove the contradiction. We didn't remove the argument. The argument is still in existence, which means there are two opposite opinions. And maybe practically we have to act according to one over the other, which also doesn't make sense because we're not following God's ruling, you see. So, but the thing is, it still remains a difference of opinion of what the law is. And so therefore we're still stuck. What does it mean? Both are the words of the living God. The first step that we have to take is this thing, is this statement. That we say both are the words of the living God only applies to halacha. It only applies to halacha, and it does not apply to any of this. It does not apply to reality. In reality, there's only one reality, and two people both can't be right. Okay? This only applies to halacha. Now, the question is, how could there be a system where two opposites could be the word of the living God? How is that possible? It means both are logical possibilities. What it means is both are logical possibilities. You have to understand something. That in science, whenever we have a problem, we're doing research and we find new facts to find the answers. In halacha, we're losing information. Why? Because the information of halacha we only get from Mount Sinai. What God gave on Mount Sinai, it's not in the physical world. You can't abstract it from the physical world. So therefore, that was which was given on Mount Sinai. So therefore, we're losing information. You see? Okay. Now, since we're losing information, in other words, God said, what is the definition of a knot? Let's say what you're not allowed to make on Shabbos. Difference of opinion, what the definition of a knot is. Now God said one. Now we're losing information. We don't know whether a knot is just putting one knot over another, or it's a professional knot. You see, the Rambam holds it's only a professional knot. Now God only said one of these, but we're losing information. We don't know which one it is. You see what I mean? It could be one or the other. Now, the thing is that both are logical. With the information that we have now, since we're losing information, with the information we have now, both are logical possibilities. Okay? Now, let's say, for instance, I'm studying Torah and I give a stupid possibility. Now, God will award me for studying Torah. I have the right to make mistakes. But however, it's not part of Torah. What I said does not become part of Torah. because it's irrational. But from the information that we have, if they're both are logical possibilities, you see, so then we say both are the words of the living God. Okay? Is that clear? Right? Well, the question is, then why does God, and in other words, then God is saying that we don't have to live by what God actually said. That's what we brought in with the Sanhedrin, that we don't have to live by what God actually said. So the question is, what is the best system? The best system, what God gave, or the other one? Or the other possibility? And which one does God want us to live by? You see? So the answer is that it is God's will that we maintain the system. God gave us the responsibility to maintain the system. And since he gave it over to the human being to maintain the system, it's going to be maintained as a human being. As a human being, it comes out different viewpoints, different opinions. And both are acceptable in the system of Torah because that's God's will that it should be given over to the human being, that he has the responsibility to maintain Torah, and therefore the way we keep Torah is according to the way the human has analyzed it and interpreted it. In fact, if a prophet comes down, and Moshe Rabbeinu himself came down now and says, I could tell you, you're not keeping the law the way I said on Mount Sinai, we're not allowed to listen to him. We're not allowed to listen to him because then we're making a decision based on prophecy. Prophecy is through God. Then we are not maintaining the system. And that is not God's will. God's will is not that he should maintain it, but it's that we should maintain it. In fact, what Manette mentioned before, there was a difference of opinion. And one rabbi said, if I am right, let a voice from heaven come out saying I am right. And a voice from heaven came out, said he is right. And the other one stood up and says, Lo b'ashamayim, it is not in heaven. God cannot make a decision in halacha. God cannot make a decision in halacha. He created the system. He created the system. That is where God. But however, after that, then God said, no, now you maintain it. And as a human being, when you maintain it, there will be different possibilities, and he placed within the system what to do when you have different possibilities. You have a Sanhedrin, you have a Supreme Court that vote on it, and you must live by that. The question is, when the daughters of Tzelophehad came to Moses, and they said that we want an inheritance, and according to the facts that Moses had at that time, they should not get an inheritance. And then he went to God, and God said that you should have an inheritance. So therefore you see that Moshe went to God for the interpretation of the law, and we're saying that God wanted us to maintain the law. How come God answered Moshe at that time? So that is the question. The answer is that during Moshe's lifetime, that was the time of the creation of the system. At that time, it was still God was giving it. It was only after Moshe died that it was closed down, that there was nothing new. But it was Moshe who, God through Moshe, gave the Torah. So while Moshe was alive, God was still giving it. That was the basic foundation and system of Torah. So the thing is that's where Moshe went to God. But however, afterwards there's a Gemara that says that Yeshua went to God, and God said, it is not in heaven. You see? And he says, set up a Sanhedrin, a Supreme Court, and make your own decisions. You see? So you see that the difference is in the creating of the system and in the... the creating of the system and the maintaining of the system. The question is that if we're losing information, then at a certain point the system should be gone. The answer is no. The answer is that the basic foundation is never lost. In other words, like this. Men have to wear tefillin, okay? Now, there's no difference of opinion that tefillin have to be square, it has to be painted black, and it has to be straps, okay? There's a difference of opinion in the tefillin that you put on your head. There's no difference of opinion that there's four boxes. It's made up of four separate compartments. And in the separate compartments, there's four different parchments from Torah. There's a difference of opinion about the order. You see? So the basic foundation is never lost. It's a certain details which come out practically to many laws that will affect us, but the details, in other words, you're not allowed to make a knot on the Sabbath. Nobody argues with that. What is the definition of a knot? What is considered a knot? That is a difference of opinion. Okay? Even among our sages, we're obligated to light Hanukkah candles. There's a difference of opinion whether we go from 1 to 8 or from 8 to 1. So the thing is that the basic foundation of the system, that we never lost. But we lose, okay? So the thing is that prayer to God means affecting the physical world, but I never change the halachic system. The halachic system is not changed by God. It's only changed by humans. The question is how could you tell when it's a detail and when it's where there's a difference of opinion and when it's the basic fact? Well, you're not allowed to make a knot on Shabbos. It's a very simple fact. That is not lost. If we lost the idea of a knot, that would be something else. That'd be the total loss. I understand. All I'm saying is what we have today is the facts as we know them. If there was a fact lost, I don't know about it. I can't know. But I'm saying what we do have is the basic foundation. You're not allowed to make a knot. Question is, what is the definition of a knot? You understand? So therefore, or for instance, some people want to say that you can't wear a watch on Shabbos. So the question is, what's the definition of wearing? But everybody agrees that you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos, but you're allowed to wear things on Shabbos. Everybody agrees with that distinction. The question is, how do you define watch? Is that wearing or carrying? In other words, if there was a different, it is impossible to be a machlokas whether you should make a knot or not make a knot on Shabbos. That is one of the basic foundations of the 39 work that you're not allowed to do on the Sabbath. Okay? So therefore, because of that, that's the basic foundation. There can never be a machlokas in that. That's a given. Those facts are there. There's no difference of opinion. There's only a difference of opinion in the details. Or for instance, there might be a difference of opinion. We know that we have 613 mitzvos. We know that. But however, there might be a difference of opinion how I categorize it. Do I categorize it as one of the 613? Or do I categorize something as a subdivision of the 613? You see? But however, what the basic foundation is, that was never lost. Whether we should make a knot or not make a knot, I mean, that's one of the, it has to fit into one of the basic 613. Either we have it or we don't have it. Okay. What I mean by losing information, I do not have the specifics, like the definition of a knot. I do not know practically what God said on Mount Sinai. That fact is lost. And now there's two different opinions that both make sense. Now maybe the Sanhedrin would tell me that I have to act one way over the other. But logically, I still have the two opinions. I still don't know which one God said on Mount Sinai. But practically, I'm obligated to act one way. That's what we mean by psak. Psak means we have to make a decision to act one way over the other, because I can't act both ways. That's a decision to practically live a certain way. But however, which one God said on Mount Sinai, I don't know.
But I mean, how do you know?
That's what I mean by losing information. And the question is that maybe God never gave us these details, and therefore that we have to work it out. The answer is, if God never gave us the details, then we don't have a complete system. You can't work this out. How are you going to work out the definition of a knot? There's no proof in the physical world. That would be an impossibility. If I could prove it from the physical world, like, for instance, the theory of physics, God didn't give us that. In the Torah, you don't have any of the theories of physics, because that you can figure out on your own. That he left, whatever man could do on his own, he left for the human to be able to do it. But however, but over here, the legal system I cannot derive from the physical world. He had to give the particulars on Mount Sinai. If he didn't, there's no way of figuring it out.
So you're saying God...
The question is, if God said, let's say, for instance, by the knot, let's say he said that only a professional knot is a knot. So the question is, then how could it come out? How could there ever come out a difference of opinion? The answer is either it was forgotten because it's part of the oral law, was not written down,
right,
or somebody understood it and it's understood it differently and made more sense because we are human. And maintaining the system as a human means that there will be mistakes, and there will be a different view of the concept of a knot. Like, what is the concept of a knot? So there are different ways in which it can develop. But however, the fact is, as a human, there's going to be changes because we are human beings. The question is it seems to be the more, as we lose information, the more differences of opinion, there seems to be a tremendous amount of confusion where we're losing the idea of a system. The answer is that when you look at, in other words, whenever there is a difference of opinion, the difference of opinion is a subdivision. Like, for instance, what's the definition of a knot? So so we subdivide between a regular knot and a professional knot. Let's say there was a difference of opinion in two types of professional knots. So then it would be a further subdivision. So the thing is, it can subdivide down to more and more details, that which is happening today, and it's subdividing more because of the different arguments, but it's still a system in the sense that the division must make sense, must be two logical possibilities. That's a clear-cut subdivision, so it's a clear system. But however, like for example, let's say, for instance, two people are learning Torah, and they both say they say stupid things. It's not rational. They're arguing, it's not rational. Now, the thing is, God chalks them up that they studied Torah. I mean, I studied Torah and I made a mistake. But I would not say both are the words of the living God, because it's irrational. So they can't be the words of the living God. When they say both are the words of the living God, it means two rational possibilities. Two rational possibilities means it's clearly subdivided from the general category. It's subdivided, and they both categories make sense and can fit in. You see? Now, you could subdivide it 3-4 times, or maybe 5 times. I don't know how much you could subdivide it. So it comes out many details, and it comes out more complex. You see? Because of all these subdivisions, it comes out very complex and how to make a decision in law. But the thing is that it must make sense. Okay? If I'm studying Torah and I make a mistake, I still study Torah. I still have fulfilled the mitzvah of studying Torah, and God chalks me up another mitzvah up there. But however, to be both of the words of the living God, there must be a clear-cut subdivision, and both are possibilities with the information that we have. And the question is that sometimes we do halacha, which we say doesn't make sense to us. The answer is, when we say it doesn't make sense to us, it doesn't make sense to us philosophically. Philosophically, I might not know the philosophical reason for a certain law, but within the system must make sense, itself, and the system must be consistent. You see, within itself, it must be consistent, and it must make sense. But however, sometimes what we mean where we don't understand is what we don't understand is the philosophical for the reason. That's a totally different subject than the system itself. Okay, there is a medrash which says that if a person had a chance to enjoy the physical world and he doesn't partake of that pleasure, he loses his portion in the world to come. Okay, that's the problem. Problem is that, I mean, that's not our philosophy. I can understand we have the right to enjoy the physical world, but if we don't enjoy it, we lose our portion in the world to come. That sounds nuts. Right? I mean, we're a religion, and the essence is to relate to God. And, okay, you want to enjoy life, we give you the right to enjoy life. But why should you lose your portion of the world to come if you don't enjoy life? And the first step that we have to take is that there are two types of pleasures which you should not partake of. One, if it's against halacha, Jewish law, so then you should not partake of that type of pleasure. And two, if it's harmful. If it's harmful, so then you should not partake of it because it will destroy you. Okay? So therefore, the Medrash cannot be talking about those two type of pleasures. That it can't be. The pleasures that are against halacha, when halacha prohibits a pleasure, it's not because of a physical harm. It's because of some spiritual benefit that you could get from it. So that's one thing. So therefore, there's the halachic because, and even if there's no philosophy behind it, because God said so, so therefore I cannot partake of that pleasure. But however, there are other pleasures that is not against halacha, which are harmful. Okay, like you got people who take drugs. I mean, you know, they go, they take this angel dust that, I mean, could destroy you in one shot. So the thing is, there's certain things that are really destructive and you should stay away from. So it's harmful. Okay? So therefore, those two things the Medrash cannot be talking about. That would be against the ideas of Torah. You're not allowed to harm yourself. And you must keep halacha. So therefore, the Medrash cannot be going against that part of our philosophy. Now the question is, which Shira asked, the question is, what is the motive of the person? In other words, like this, let's say you go out for ice cream, you're not a diabetic. If you're, in other words, it's what is harmful could sometimes be very particular to the person. So if the person is diabetic, so you shouldn't have ice cream. But the only thing is, let's say you go out, you have nothing wrong with you, you're okay, and everybody's having an ice cream, right? Now, the question is, if you would not want to partake of that ice cream, and there's nothing harmful, the question is, what would motivate you not to partake of that ice cream? One possibility is that we do live in a Christian society which holds that you should not enjoy the physical world, okay? And therefore, it could have become part of us and attached to our religion, which is really not true, but certain people, unconsciously, the society affects you and says, therefore, I should not partake of the physical pleasures because it's not right. And therefore, they attach to religion, that religion in general would not partake of the physical pleasures. That is one case of where a person refuses to take the physical. There is another, and that is this. They say that ice cream, if you eat too much ice cream, it's unhealthy. So some people say, I'll stay away from it completely. You see? And when I say that there's no health problem in eating ice cream, I mean the quantity. In other words, a small quantity is not going to harm you, but like you see kids, they have a candy bar and a soda, and that's for lunch, you know what I mean? That's unhealthy already. That's a point of unhealthy. So it's a matter of quantity, okay? Now, the thing is that, so some people say that basically, it's no good. It's better to stay away from it completely. Let's say I could guarantee that a lot of people, I say, if you would not get addicted to smoking, and you would only smoke one cigarette a week, would you smoke it? He says, no, because I wouldn't touch it. The truth is, one cigarette a week, I don't believe, will harm anybody. You see? It's so when you get to five or six a day, and then you get addicted to it and start having more. I can't guarantee you won't get addicted. That's why I would tell you not to partake. But the attitude is, no, even if I knew, I would not partake because it's bad, so I will not touch it. It becomes like an evil thing. Well, if it's going to bother you physically, if it's going to affect you physically, of course, then you should stay away from it completely. But we're talking about the case where it would not harm them at all, okay? And it's only a small quantity which would not harm them. And the difference is quantity. They say, I'd rather not partake of the whole thing and stay away from it. Okay? The question is, if you could enjoy one ice cream a week, one scoop of, let's say, without, and there's no harm at all, okay? Not have no problems, and you could enjoy it, why would you not partake of the whole thing? Why say, I won't touch ice cream at all? Stay away from it. What is the motive for that? In other words, we're talking about a person that studies Torah, keeps halacha, but however, he doesn't partake of these pleasures. Now, the question is why should he not have a portion in the world to come? Keeps all the mitzvahs, keeps all the commandments, everything he does correctly, but he doesn't partake. He says, look, I don't want to partake. It's too much is no good. A little bit won't harm me, but I'd rather stay away from it. Now, so the question is that what motivates a person to have that attitude? We notice that people, like for instance, which you just mentioned, that when they come to a full stop, a traffic light, so they will stop. They will not violate that. These very same people will speed. Okay? Question is why? Why is speeding different than stopping? Because one is quantitative. They can't make a distinction. Once you could go 60, so there's no big distinction between 60 and 75. You understand? It's just a number. While one is stopping, a complete act of stopping, and that's it. Okay. Now the question is, why is it that people cannot make the quantitative distinction? You see? That is where what we want to analyze is why a person cannot make that quantitative distinction. So Fred says that they put everything in the category of good and bad. Either ice cream is good or ice cream is bad. Okay? Everything is in a box. Now again, I'll ask you the question. What part of the human being does this? That puts everything in a box of good and evil. In other words, according to the quality, according to the object, what part of the person does this that actually separates between good and evil based on the quality and not evaluating the quantity? So therefore, once ice cream is mostly harmful, if you have the quantity is too much, so then they say the quality is no good. Okay? So they can't measure, that's why they can't measure quantity. Now the question is, what part of the person does this come from? We want to say the component which doesn't let you evaluate whether everything is good or evil is the conscience. You see, the conscience just knows that certain things are good, certain things are evil. Okay? And therefore, he can't evaluate that maybe I can have ice cream once a week, there's absolutely no harm, and therefore why shouldn't I partake of it? That the conscience can't deal with. And the conscience has all the fears of everything you were saying. Like you were saying that, well, maybe I'll get addicted to ice cream if I have once a week. Maybe I'll get addicted to this. See, that's the conscience speaking. That constant fear of being addicted is the conscience warning you off against the whole quality. You see? That is the component why people cannot partake of the pleasures, the quantitative amount, which is not too much, just a little bit, They can't partake of that. We have an animalistic part of us, okay? The animalistic part doesn't know the word no. Whatever it desires, like you see by a child, whatever it desires, it wants now. Doesn't recognize other people's things, doesn't recognize ownership, only what I want. The parent trains the child to control themselves. That the reason why the child can be trained is because the child has a conscience. So therefore, when you say no, that becomes part of the conscience, and that stops the person from acting. Okay? But that conscience can only attach to the quality. It uses, to help it, it uses the components of the conscience, fear, shame, and guilt. You see, so therefore you're controlled. You have fears, different fears, whatever these fear, shame, and guilt is. But the thing is that the conscience says no to the animalistic part. You'll see that when Adam and Eve, they were totally nude. Then when they ate from the tree, so they went in hiding, and God said, "Where are you?" He said, "We're hiding because we're ashamed that we're nude." Says, "How did you know to be? How did you know that? How did you know to be ashamed?" You see, so when they partook of the tree of knowledge, they didn't exactly get knowledge, but what they got was a conscience. See, that was the creation of the conscience, and there are classes, there are tapes by Rabbi Chait which explain the whole thing, how it works and what happened there. But the basic thing, without any big going into a big deal, you see that the conscience was created at that time, and you see the component of the conscience was shame, and if you look around, you see fear and guilt also are there. So that was, but it was created to make you feel ashamed. That's why we feel ashamed when if we walk around nude, we feel ashamed. You see? That is the definition of the conscience. Now, but the conscience only knows to make a judgment on the quality. This is wrong. This is right. You see? But it can't measure the quantity. In other words, it's not that the conscience says that eating ice cream is harmful. It becomes bad. In the eyes of the conscience, eating ice cream is bad. You see? It becomes bad. You see, smoking is not harmful, it's bad. It becomes evil. You see? So the physical world, that's why you find a lot of religions, the physical world, the physical pleasures, are evil. They define it as evil. That is the conscience speaking, not looking, let's just leave it at that. That's the conscience speaking. So therefore, you have to say that when he relates through the conscience, he is not, in other words, to make the distinction, what makes a distinction when I could eat ice cream? You see, that a certain amount of ice cream and the quantity that I could eat, you see, that quantity, that distinction can only be made by the mind, you see. So therefore, if you're guided by the conscience, so you're not guided by reality. If you live in a society like the United States, so sometimes a person lives by his conscience, it looks like he's living in reality. But that same person, if he was raised in Haiti, let's say 100 years ago, he'd be sticking pins in dolls, you understand, and relating to voodoo, you understand. It's the way you're raised. We happen to be raised in society which is a certain amount practical, and it happens to be true. Too much ice cream is unhealthy. So you don't realize that it's the conscience that's making you make these decisions, but it's not because you have a sense of reality, and it's not because you're guided by the sense of reality. You understand? You're guided by your conscience and not a sense of reality. Because the sense of reality would say, just for a minute, one scoop a week is not going to harm me. You see? That would reality say. But however, like a doctor one time told me, he says, you should go on a diet. Diet is don't bloat yourself. Never bloat yourself. You know, one minute, one minute. He says, once a month you can bloat yourself. You see? That's the mind speaking, you see, where the quantity, you know what I mean? You have to evaluate the quantity. But however, once you don't evaluate the quantity, it's the conscience that is running your life and removes these type of pleasures, because they can't measure quantity, they can only judge on the quality. So since most of the quantity is no good, so they judge it as evil. It's not harmful, it's a wrong definition. They're saying it's evil, it's not evil. It's harmful, too much is harmful, this much is not harmful. See, only the mind can make that distinction. And even evil, I mean, they according to them, they hold that thou shalt not kill. Okay? But we all know. We hold thou shalt not murder. There's a difference between murder and killing. We're not against killing. If you read the Chumash and Tanakh, you know, I mean, we have where we went to war and God told us to wipe out people. It was an obligation to destroy people. So we're not against killing. Well, we're against murder. Even that, you have to make a distinction. But the church says, no, thou shalt not kill, because they cannot make, they're not guided by the mind, they're guided by the conscience. So since they're guided by the conscience, they're not guided by the mind. In other words, you have to do the research on the exact quantity of any pleasure, where it is harmful and where it's not. Okay, so there you should partake of the pleasure after you did the research. You made your decision, you can partake unless you get new information. So then you have to change. Then you change what you thought before. Okay? So the thing is that, but there has to be an evaluation based on research. So then the mind has to make a distinction on the quantity of how much is good and how much is no good. In other words, even, like I said before, even if the society is in line with reality, and you follow that reality because of your conscience, you see, therefore you're not, the mind is not making reality, you're not operating based on reality, you're based on the conscience, you see. You're correct. In other words, it's not what you're doing, the act. Like, let's say you don't partake of ice cream, you know, that's a healthy thing, but it shows something about your personality, that you're guided by your conscience and not by your mind. The question is whether the conscience is a helpful thing or whether we should give it up. The answer is you can't live without the conscience. It's a component of the human being, okay? But a person can use the conscience as a result of his knowledge. In other words, let's say he finds out that one scoop of ice cream a week is good, then the conscience could help him to make sure he doesn't have more than one. Then the conscience is a tool of the mind. But if the conscience is controlling the person, you see, and controls the way he operates, that you have to start out that way. Every human being starts out that way, but at a certain point in your development, you should become a thinker and start being guided by thought and not by the conscience. Now, to get a portion in the world to come, person must be guided by reality. Okay? Now, if he's guided totally by his conscience, then the reason why he studies Torah is not because he sees the reality, but because his conscience tells him that he should study Torah. So then even the study of Torah is not in reality. You see? In other words, at a certain point, in other words, it's good to start out. That's why we say, lo lishma bo lishma. If you have an incorrect motive, it's not if you have an incorrect motive. Everybody must start studying Torah with an incorrect motive, namely the conscience. Okay? So the thing is that the conscience gets him to study, then the study itself helps him be guided by the ideas, and to start guiding yourself by ideas instead of the conscience. You see, that is a change that should come about through the study of Torah, or through your study of Musa, the world of how to live life, like we're discussing pleasure and these things, this study. So therefore, that helps when you start discussing these things and start seeing these things. So it helps you move from the area of the conscience to the world of ideas. And then the ideas become real to you, and you're guided by those ideas. But if you can't make these type of distinctions, it means you're still guided by the conscience, which means Torah is not real to you, therefore you don't have a portion in the world to come, because the Torah is not real to you. The religious emotion is a component of the conscience. Okay? Your religion, according to Torah, if you follow the ideas of Torah, the religion should be guided by the mind. And if I had to define it, I would call it a religion of mind. Well, you're guided by the mind, and the mind guides you to the truth of this religion. No, not by the conscience. The conscience is a good way of starting. And the religious emotion is a good way of starting. You see? But if it gets away from you, if it goes too far, you understand, then you will not be, you won't see the ideas, then it could be a problem. You won't see the reality. Hey, we're going to discuss what is Musar. Okay? Sadigan says, in his introduction to Mishlei, Proverbs, he says that there are two basic drives of every human being: the desire to avoid pain and the desire for pleasure. Those are the two basic drives. Okay? Now there are two ways of looking at it. There's immediate pain and pleasure, and there's pain and pleasure in the future. So he says the purpose of Mishlei is to help you relate to the pain and pleasure that is in the future. Okay? So you could evaluate the immediate pain and pleasure versus the pain and pleasure of the future. That is the purpose of Mishlei. Now the thing is like this. Every human being has a certain sense of reality. That sense of reality attaches to the five senses and also to proximity of an action. In other words, you're going to have a test in a month. Does not affect you until the night before. The proximity makes it real enough for you to do something about it. But a month before, it's not real enough to do anything about it. Okay? So you see, your sense of reality attaches to proximity of a certain action or the physical, or the physical itself. Now, therefore, if you want to extend if you do extend the sense of reality to the world of ideas, then the consequences of your actions and future results of what you do or don't do today will be real to you, so that it can evaluate, so that you can evaluate the future versus the present, and see whether an act is worth doing or not. Now, a person that can do this is called a chacham. And why is he called a chacham? Why is he called wise? See, the immediate, you have an experience right now. You're having an experience. The future, you only know based on your mind. So therefore, if you make a decision based on the future, not on the experience, so you're making a decision based on your mind over the experience, that is a chacham. Chacham is not a person that has knowledge. A wise person is not a person that has knowledge, but he's able to make decisions despite his emotions. And therefore, that is when he gets the title of chacham. I'd like to give you two examples of how it works. Somebody has to go in for an operation for, I was present at the time this was happening, and it was basically for pain. And she had great fears about this operation. So the doctor said to her, if you have the operation, then you'll be able to do exercise, which is healthy. So, first, psychologically, it's a good outlet. Two, physically, it's healthy. It could also help you lose weight. And also, if you're in pain, you can't have a social life. You lose that on your social life, which is an important thing. So, that's all the doctor said. I'd just like to add the point like this. See, the immediate experience is fear. You see? That fear takes over and could make a decision. What the doctor was doing is showing the results of the operation and to help her overcome the fear through the through telling her the results of the future. That would be chachma over the immediate experience. Another example would be let's say, for instance, a braggart. Now, most people cannot stand a braggart, and they think braggart is disgusting. The reason why they feel that way is because it is not acceptable in society. It's not acceptable. So, therefore, a lot of the traits that people are against is because it's not acceptable in society. But insofar as we're concerned, we want to see the benefit or harm of being a braggart, okay? Now, a braggart is a need, whatever the cause is, it's a need to brag, okay? That's the experience. But however, there are certain results of that. Well, first of all, people don't like a braggart, so you lose your friends. You could lose your social life. Two, if people don't like you, if you start bragging, so you affect them in a bad way because it's as if you're putting them down. Because when you brag about something, so they feel like put down, so they have to hate you. If they hate you, then they could gossip about you, talk bad things. If anybody comes for a recommendation of any sort, they will give a bad one because they don't like you. So therefore, the consequence of a braggart is, in other words, the immediate is whatever the need to brag is. Sometimes it's a bad self-image, or whatever it might be. But the thing is that the results are that you'll make enemies. Enemies is always a bad thing to have, because you never know how they can harm you, either behind your back or sometimes to the front of you, but it's bad to have an enemy, because they're always out to get you. So therefore, braggart brings about not only you push away people, but you make enemies of them because they hate you, because to them it's like a put-down. That is why we would be against a braggart. Now the question is how to get to the point where you can extend the sense of reality from the five senses to the world of ideas. Okay? Now, the only way to do it is to study these type of examples. Every pasuk and mishle does it for you. I mean, you have to abstract it and work with it, but practically every pasuk and mishle is either dealing with the wicked and the righteous, or the wise and the fool. Okay? Now, in each case, as you evaluate the benefit of the wise and the consequence of the fool, or the righteous and the wicked, then, and you check and you test, in other words, you question it until it becomes 100% clear to the mind, and once that becomes clear to the mind, then that affects you. Then you take, and it's not to use or even to remember. You don't have to remember. It's to see it clear. And review is good because review helps you see things clearer. And then you go to the another verse and another verse, and as you continue going from verse to verse, it affects you in such a way that after a while, suddenly you'll notice in certain areas you'll be able to start making decisions based on your mind instead of your feelings. In other words, the consequence doesn't only have to be in the physical world, in the practical. I mean, it is, but the consequence could also be in your suffering. There's certain emotions that cause you conflict, and when you carry it out, it causes a conflict. That is also a consequence of bad emotions, and therefore you have to you could evaluate it based on those consequences also. On the conflict of the emotions. And you could, that last point about the consequence of emotions, you could look at it in two ways. You could look at it in terms of the consequence also. In other words, if the person loses his friends, or people talk about him and he should hear about it, that's going to cause terrible conflict. So the consequences is not only in the physical, but when you get the physical consequences, there is emotional consequences. You will be in conflict. You understand? So therefore, that's in one way that it's a conflict. Two, usually the emotion itself by nature is in conflict. Let's take bragging. Like bragging, one of the possibilities of bragging is a bad self-image. So what happens is you have a bad self-image, and to overcome the bad self-image, you brag. You see? But you're not dealing, it's an escape, and you're not dealing with the bad self-image. Bad self-image doesn't go away when you brag. So therefore, it's like a person that's addicted to, addicted to smoking. So when the addiction is awakened, when he gives in to the cigarette, it's not a removal of the addiction. On the contrary, it makes the addiction worse. Therefore, he can't get away from it. It's not dealing with the addiction. The same thing over here. When he brags, he's giving in to the addiction, and the addiction can only get worse. But he never deals with the core issue, namely of his bad self-esteem. So since he hasn't dealt with his bad self-esteem, so he's in conflict over that. You see, that has to be affecting him, that he's putting a tremendous amount of energy in avoiding dealing with it. By constantly bragging, he's avoiding dealing with the conflict of the bad self-image. You see? So therefore, he's getting into more and more conflict, one, within himself, and two, the consequences of being a braggart will cause also conflict, which will make the conflict a very high and powerful problem in the future. The question is about today they give self-esteem, like by children, and raising children, they feel it's important to have self-esteem by giving them compliments. I'm saying you have to be very, very careful, because first of all, the child will get used to the compliment. He'll do things for a compliment. So he's not doing because he enjoys it. And you also, the parent has to be careful that once he gets used to the compliment, it's not only the parent's compliment that he needs. He needs his peers' compliment. And therefore, it's because of that he can get into a lot of trouble, because he'll have to do things that his peers want him to do, so that once he gets the compliment, he'll do it. So he's caught up in that peer pressure. The parent doesn't realize that the parent thinks that they'll always have the control through the parent's compliment, but it can happen that, and it does happen, at a certain point, children start hanging around with others, and they need the compliment of the peers. Okay, that's the first problem with that. All right, we just would like to clarify that last point, and that is this. When we say a compliment, we don't say you shouldn't compliment. In other words, it's a matter of degree. If you go too far, it's close to flattery, and if you go too little, then the child will need acceptance from some place, so they'll turn to the other place. So the thing is we're talking the extremes will bring about this problem. Okay? Now, all I'm saying is that idea of self-esteem went, from what I could see in a lot of cases, they went too far. In other words, and they just built on the positive. They never pointed out the negative and never corrected a kid. That could be a dangerous precedent, which can make the child very dependent on that type of compliment. Okay? And also, the second thing is that the child is not doing things because they relate to it. They do it because of the recognition that they're going to get. So they really can't enjoy the activities that they do because they become goal-oriented and they cannot relate and enjoy the activity itself because they're trained in the compliment. Okay? Just a clarification, and that is that we see in advertisement it's based on flattery and business is based on flattery. It'll be better to raise your child to be able to see truth and reality so they don't get fooled by these people that are trying to con them, you see, in all different situations. So therefore, raising a child through a compliment, it would not be a beneficial thing. All right. Sheila wants to add another situation where you compliment. And that is sometimes a person, there are situations where sometimes you are jealous of another person. And instead of allowing the jealousy to come through, so you compliment the person, and that way you identify with the person, and therefore when you identify with the person, so then you don't feel the jealousy. It helps relieve the pain of jealousy. Instead of feeling jealous, you identify with the person, so therefore it's like complimenting yourself, because identification means the other person is an extension of yourself. So when you're an extension of yourself, so you avoid the jealousy. So sometimes compliments are used in that fashion. The question is that good or bad? Okay, practically it helps the person that you're identifying with because you won't destroy them. Okay? But the fact is, insofar as the person's self is concerned, they're not dealing with their jealousy. They have to constantly do that. So that, in other words, again, they're in conflict and they're just feeding the conflict. It's like like an addiction, and you're just feeding the addiction, but you're not dealing with the basic problem. Okay, there is a in Mishlei, it's Perek Aleph, Pasuk Zayin. That's chapter 1, verse 7. It says, the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. And then the second half of the verse says, wisdom and musa fools disgrace or degrade. Okay? Now, I'm not interested in analyzing the verse itself, but just to show, but every pasuk is always opposites. So since the first half is talking about Yiras Hashem and the fear of God, and the second half deals with wisdom and musar, so therefore chachma and musar must be some aspect of the fear of God. You see, so there, because it's two sides of the same verse, so therefore the verse must deal with the same subject, but different the way the wise person should operate and the way the fool operates. You see. So, but anyway, what we've just proven from here, that fear of God in a wise person seems to be synonyms. Okay? We'd like to explain what the fear of God is based on this idea. There are two types of a fear of God. One is fear, and one is awe. Okay. What we don't mean by fear is the fear of a... of God, like people have, like religious people have a certain fear of God. That is not what it means, because then the opposite would not be wisdom. You understand? Because, I mean, the synonym would not be wisdom, because that type of fear is based on any, you can be totally ignorant of religion, knowledge of God, but you have a certain fear of God, and even your understanding of who God is and everything like that is simply based on ignorance. So fear of God cannot be that type of fear. Okay? It must be based on wisdom. Okay. Fear of God means where I'm afraid of the consequences. Okay? Now, there are two types of consequences. The consequences in everyday life, which is the subject of Proverbs, basically. But there also are religious losses. One is that there is a system called Hashkacha Pratis, or God's personal supervision. Okay? And that works based, in other words, there the way it works is that the physical world is affected by me. Okay? In other words, in the laws of nature, the laws of nature, I do not affect the laws of nature. I am living within the laws of nature. Hashkacha Pratis, or God's personal supervision, is a system whereby my relationship to truth, God, and so the laws of nature will be affected by my relationship to God. You see? So therefore, if I do evil, first of all, I'll be harmed in the everyday way. That's one type of harm. Two is, in Hashkacha Pratis, let's say the nation can be affected by the nation doing evil. So therefore we're affected by Hashkacha Pratis. That's also a consequence. So the fear of God means that I fear I recognize consequences, and I recognize the harm that it could do to me, whether in the laws of nature or whether by God's personal supervision. You see, I recognize the harm that it could do to me. You see, and therefore I avoid doing the incorrect. I avoid doing the incorrect act, so I shouldn't get the consequences of my actions, or I should get the benefit results of my actions if I stay away from the bad thing and do the correct thing. Or, on the other hand, in other words, in Hebrew, it's the same word, yira. But however, you could translate it as fear or awe. We just got through explaining fear. Awe comes from a study of God's universe. And when you recognize God's universe, you stand in awe of God's wisdom. And you relate to God because he is the source of all reality. And you are drawn to truth and reality through your studies of the different sciences, the different aspects of the physical world. You're drawn to truth, and then when you see God through his wisdom, then you stand in awe of his world and awe of the creator of all this beautiful wisdom. That is a higher level. And we must start with the lower level. You can't start with the higher level, because you must start with the lower level, because you must extend the sense of reality from your five senses to a sense of to the world of ideas. You see? So therefore, you must start on the lower level and then work up to the higher level. So there's also a term, serving from love. According to the Rambam, it's two sides of the same coin. Awe and love, in other words, are two sides of the same coin. It's a result of your knowledge of God's universe, and through the knowledge of God's universe, you relate to God and his wisdom. Now, the difference between awe and love, they're two sides of the same coin. Love means I want to search out God. In other words, when Einstein saw the theory of relativity, then he wanted to know who God is. He was curious to know who God is. You see? That's love of God, when you're drawn to search out who God, whatever you can know about God, okay? Fear is awe of God means the other side. In other words, I stand like trembling and like I feel like humility. It's like a humility thing in the presence of greatness. It's a certain type of humility that I look up to in awe. not searching for God, it's standing in awe of God. That's what I think. That's what I think the two sides are. The question is, what is the benefit of tefillah? Okay. Now I'd like to start out by saying that tefillah works because we know from Torah that not that tefillah would be ridiculous if it didn't work. I mean, if we pray to God, God can answer us if He wants to. You understand? So it does work.
But how does it work?
In other words, when you pray to God, there is a special hashkacha, practice, a special personal God supervision that He can listen to your prayers and affect the laws of nature so that they could fit into your desire. That is, that would be tefillah. That would be the benefit of tefillah. Well, the question is, how do we know that it works? Well, if it didn't work, I mean, then the words of tefillah would be absolutely worthless. I mean, it's a fake. We're saying, God, help me to have health, wealth, and wisdom. I mean, and it's not true. God will not help us. So why are we saying it if it doesn't work? We're going to discuss what the benefit of prayer is, even when God doesn't listen to us. That we're going to discuss. But however, I'm just starting out when we get into the philosophy of the benefit of tefillah to us personally, that does not mean that God does not listen to it, to the prayer. I mean, God does hear the prayer, and He will decide whether He will listen, but there is a special hashkacha pratis, personal supervision by God that He does listen to prayer. And it can work. In different situations, it can work. And it can change the facts. Sometimes not on a personal level, sometimes on a group prayer, whatever. It could be different things, you see. So different situations. So that I'm accepting because of the Torah. I don't have a philosophical proof that the tefillah works. I'm just saying based on the tefillah itself, the words of tefillah itself, it has to work. Based on the sages, and the sages is the carrier of the oral law. In other words, even if you're not on the level, personally, to have God relate to you personally, you might not be on that level, but however, tefillah works. There's a special hashkacha on tefillah. Okay? There's a special personal God's personal supervision on the tefillah that it can relate back to the person, even though the person is not on the level. Now, of course, the tefillah of a person that's on the level is a totally different ballpark. In other words, when I mean listen, God hears all prayers, but whether He will do something about it, that depends on many, many factors, on other factors besides the prayer. So, therefore, but God listens to the prayer, but whether He'll do something about it is up to God. The question is whether it's only prayer that our sages wrote, or can a person make up his own prayer? Now, the first thing is that you have to know is that that there's certain laws about prayer. So, if you don't fulfill the laws of prayer, then it's not a real prayer, as we understand it. And two, there's certain ideas that you must know about God and about prayer to write a prayer. In other words, if you write a prayer and it's the wrong idea of God, that's not a real prayer. But our sages who understood the laws of prayer and who understood the nature of God and how God relates to us and what is necessary to bring about that God will listen to us, therefore we use the prayers of our sages, and therefore that will be a greater chance of God listening than the other way, which would not be considered a prayer, which would not be defined as a prayer. The thing is I want to say the benefit of tefillah, besides the hashkacha pratis, besides that God listens to prayer, on the lowest level, I understand there are other ideas of tefillah that are for a higher level, but for the lower level is like this. We have what's called the religious emotion. Okay? Hold on one second. And we have what is known as religious emotion. Okay? And that emotion guides most people in their life. And that emotion tells me who God is and how I should relate to God. Okay? Any religion that was not authenticated by God must come about that way. Okay? Now the real true ideas of God is not in line with these religious emotions. For instance, if you look at Ashrei, which we have an obligation to say three times a day, and sages say that if you say it three times a day, you're guaranteed to be a fear of the Lord. It's all it's talking about is the animal kingdom and how God relates to the animal kingdom. I mean, it would not satisfy that religious emotion. Religious emotion is looking for, you know, hey God, do something for me, and I'm close to God, and you know, I'm God's lieutenant. You know what I mean? All these things is very close to God. All Ashrei does is go over in other words, if you ever watch nature programs, it'll tell you what to look for when you watch a nature program, so you can see God in nature. Okay, that's really what Ashrei is all about. Okay, we discussed it, I think it's on one of the tapes that we had, all the ideas, the basic ideas of Ashrei. Okay, so the thing is that once you understand how that causes you to relate to God through God's systems, and you see God's systems, so then through that you relate to God. Now the thing is, if I would tell you that, maybe your mind would accept it, but when you walk out emotionally, you're still the other way. Your emotions still go back to God in the old religious emotional way. Whatever your religious emotion defines God and how it says it should relate to God, it's still there, you see. So by reviewing these ideas, you see, it becomes a part of you. When it becomes second nature, then it's easier for God to listen to your prayers, because now you're closer to God.